Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. In this revised, updated, and expanded edition, the author explores the life of Theodore Bundy, one of the more infamous and flamboyant American serial killers on record. Bundy's story is a complex mix of psychopathology, criminal investigation, and the U.S. legal system. This in-depth examination of Bundy's life and his killing spree that totaled dozens of victims is drawn from legal transcripts, correspondence, and interviews with detectives and prosecutors. Using these sources, new information about several murders is unveiled. The biography follows Bundy from his broken family background to his execution in the electric chair. The book that we're featuring this evening is The Bundy Murders, A Comprehensive History, Second Edition, with my special guest journalist and author, Kevin Sullivan. Welcome back to the program. Thank you very much for this interview, Kevin Sullivan.
Hey, Dan. How things going? I'm happy to be back. I know we always have a great time when we talk about Ted Bundy, and now we're revisiting the book that started it all, The Bundy Murders, and this time it's the second edition, so I look forward to our talk.
Absolutely. It's always great to have you on as the resident world expert on Ted Bundy, and as you mentioned, this is where it all started, this book, The Bundy Murders. About 10 years ago, as you write in this second edition. Tell us, though, let's go back. Tell us about the incredible, like you say, nothing less than surreal events which led to the writing of this first edition of the book. Tell us about this.
Sure. It's interesting. I never had any intention of writing about Ted Bundy. I mean, I was familiar with the case, but there's a Louisville connection to the Bundy story, and it was in the person of Jim Massey. He was a friend of mine. He was a probation parole officer here in Louisville, Kentucky for many, many years, and he retired out after 30 years. He passed away a couple of years ago. But he was a friend of Jerry Thompson. He had known the retired investigator, Utah investigator, and I should say the lead investigator for the Bundy case in Utah. He had known him since the mid to early 1980s. And so we would occasionally talk about Bundy. I hadn't read any books about, you know, Ted Bundy, but we would talk about it. And when Jerry and his wife Jean were coming to Louisville back in May of 2005, I got a call. And of course, you know, they've been friends with Jim. And so that, you know, he called Jim and he said, well, you know, we'll be in Louisville in May. This was like in March. So Jim called me and he said, listen, the Thompsons are coming to Louisville in May. Would you like to have dinner with us? I said, sure. I think that would be great. I would love to. At the time, I only had one book to my name, and that was my first book, Shattering the Myth, Signposts on Custer's Road to Disaster. And I was writing a true crime book. And I was also writing, I wasn't on staff, but I was writing occasionally feature articles for a local newspaper, which was really published in Lexington, Kentucky and Louisville, Kentucky, and in about five other states. The paper was called Snitch, and it had to do with the crime and the law. And so I did several features for them and some others in the pipeline when the paper went out of business. But in any event, I said, yeah, because I wanted to meet, you know, Jerry. I'd heard things about him, and it was my only opportunity to meet, somebody that was connected with the case. I didn't think it was going to lead to anything, really. So I got to meet Jerry, and what happened was on the Sunday that they arrived into Louisville, Jim called me, and he let me know where we were going to be eating dinner. And I was about to say, okay, well, I'll see you there, whatever. And he said he brought the bag. And I said, what bag? He said the bag Bundy carried, like his murder kit. He said, I have it with me now in my truck. So I said, listen, Jim, could I meet you a few minutes early? Earlier than when we're supposed to, meet them in the parking lot of the restaurant. He said, sure. So, I got in the car. I drove up to Golden Corral. And it was not too far from my house up here in the Hikes Point area. And the Thompsons were staying about a half a mile down the road at a place called the Breckenridge Inn. And so I got there, and as soon as I rolled in, it was Jim in his truck. He was getting out of the truck. He saw me. And he was carrying this brown satchel. And that was Bundy's murder kit. And it was encased in a large, clear plastic bag that Jerry had it in. Because he's had this bag ever since Bundy was executed. He got it from, the Salt Lake County Sheriff's Office evidence room. And he used it as teaching tools. Anyway, so I got to look at all this stuff. And went back to the Breckenridge Inn, afterwards and sat around. And I interviewed Jerry and just a really, really, really nice guy. And what I did was I wrote an article for Snitch about having this bag. Oh, and I need to tell you this. On the second, he turned the bag over to Jim for as long as they were in Louisville, and they were here about 4 days. So I got to meet him that night. I got to see the stuff. It's a gym bag, a brown one. It had two right-handed gloves in it. They were different ones, a puffy ski type. The other's a brown, a light brown woolen glove with a darker brown, like leather palm area. And it had electrical cord, which you would use very often for choking. It had rope and strips of sheet for binding of hands and feet. It had a ski mask. It had glad bags because he would always take the clothes of the victims. And, if they were found at all, they were found nude. They might have a beaded necklace on them, but he would always put the clothes, this is before real DNA was there, but still, there could be connecting hairs and things. So he would get rid of those in the dumpster down the road. And this particular glad box was a box of 10, and there were three missing. So he had that, and there was an ice pick, a flashlight, just the tools of the trade of murder for Bundy. And so I called Jim a couple days later, and I said, listen, could I bring that stuff over to my house to photograph it? He said, sure. I went by Jim's house. It had just gotten dark, and I picked up the bag. I put it in the passenger seat of my car, and I started driving. And it was so surreal having Ted Bundy's murder kit with me. And I looked over in the passenger seat, and because it was dark, I'm going down the streets, and there'd be street lamps occasionally. And when I would pass one, the bag would be kind of dark, and then here comes the street light, and then it had this eerie glow. It would shine on the bag, and then it was. So I called my wife, and I said, listen, honey, I said, we probably don't have anything on the dining room table, but if we do, could you kind of clear it off? And I'm bringing Ted Bundy's murder kit into the house because I want to photograph it. And my son-in-law was there, and my wife, she doesn't really like things like this, but she said, oh, okay, sure, that's fine. And so I took it to my house. My son-in-law at the time, he was able to arrange it in different ways, and I was taking pictures. And then I took the bag back to Jim later that night. And when the Thompsons left Louisville, 4 days later, Jim said, why don't you meet us over at the Breckenridge Inn? So we went over there, and we took some more pictures and talked. And while he was waiting on his wife, she was doing some things in the room. Jerry was down with us in the parking lot. Jim had popped the tail thing on his truck, and Jerry was sitting on it, and the bag was there. So we took more photographs, and before Jerry left, he gave me and he gave Jim each one of the glad bags taken from Ted Bundy's murder kit. And I said, Jerry, would you mind writing a letter of authentication? And he said, sure. So I didn't have any paper on me, so I walked into the Breckenridge Inn, and I got some of their large stationery, you know, like if I wanted to type out a letter in the Breckenridge Inn, it's across the top. And I had, he wrote one out for each of us. I said, thank you so much. Well, I wrote an article for Snitch, and this appeared, I think, in June or July of 2005. And I thought, you know, I would get all of this out of my system in, you know, in, you know, just by doing this article.
Right.
And so it was published. It was well received, but it didn't leave my system. And the funny thing is I kept wanting to know more about that. Just having that glad trash bag and having that kid in my house and meeting Jerry, I have to say it was more the kid than even meeting Jerry. Because I would have written an article even without the kid about Jerry. But it was having those items that were so close to Ted Bundy, and there was, in my house, there was no museum curator or a detective there to tell me what to do with it. And it was just surreal. So that was the impetus. That was the thing that really drove me to start writing about Ted Bundy. And I mentioned to Massey I was going to write a book, and I told some others, and they said, listen, Bundy has been done to death. You don't need to be writing a book about him. But as I've often said, sometimes you have to go with not what people say, but what you know on the inside you need to be doing, when you really know you should be doing it. And I did. And so, you know, I wrote the book, and I remember thinking halfway through the book, I was finding out new things never before published about several of these murders, and a tremendous amount of new information about the case in general. And of course it turned out to be the smartest move I've ever made, because the book has been a good seller it was published in August of 2009. At the time, nobody really knew who I was. So it took a while for that to get going. But once, you know, a number of people, you know, read the book, who were more like influential, and they knew other people, and they told other people. And, you know, all of a sudden, after a while, people started knowing who I was in this. And the book has, you know, just done nothing but built and built and built over the years. And, you know, in 2017, well, I should say I had documentarians contacting me as early as 2010 about my book. And the American documentary makers really didn't get, I guess, the message about me for a long time, or perhaps they weren't making any docs about Bundy. But by 2017, I had just a number of documentarians from the United States and the UK and contacting me about Bundy, along with many national magazines and publications wanting information. And all of these documentary makers, the one thing they had in common, they all had my book, The Bundy Murders, A Comprehensive History. And some of them asked me to come on the show, but even those ones that didn't, or the ones like Netflix at the last minute asked me to do it, but I could not get to New York in the time frame that they asked me, and so I couldn't do the doc. But he said, I got your book. And I said, well, I'm glad, because there's a lot in there that you can make use of. So it's been a real experience. And of course, this is the book that I never expected to ever write anything more than this book on Bundy, which is the full treatment of the murders and what I would call the full biography. And then of course in 2015, because of some people that have passed away and some information that I had, I decided to write what is known as a companion volume to that, which became The Trail of Ted Bundy. And interestingly enough, I was able to uncover new information in that book that is people who had never talked before, like Larry Anderson, who out of Utah, who was a good friend of Ted Bundy's. He told me, he said, you know, when I hunted him down, he said, I was offered a lot of money by one of the national magazines several days after Bundy was executed to give my testimony about it, but I just didn't want to do it. So then he ends up talking to me 20 years later, doesn't ask for a dime, And that, and there's a lot of testimonies in there that have never been in print before. And so I thought, great, that's a good companion volume. And then the next year, because of some other things that happened, I did write another book, and that was called The Bundy Secrets. And in that, another group of new testimonies, as well as a republication of the record, and then commentary from me, because people love seeing different parts of the record. Then another one I did a year or so later called Ted Bundy's Murderous Mysteries. And it's a deeper look into the victims. And just it turned out to be a really good book. I gathered a lot of information. There was, again, new testimonies that had never come to the printed page before. You know, like the Bundy Secrets. I interviewed a woman named Louise Cannon, and outside of detectives in Utah, no writer has ever interviewed her or really sought her out. Ted tried to work for at a bank, and so her story's in there. And what's interesting about Louise Cannon's story is Louise, who already knew Ted in Utah, and Ted always chatted her up and was, you know, it was just like almost like the life of the party. She ran into him one night at a bar, around a little before 8:30 p.m. And it was October 18th, 1974. And that was just about an hour and a half before he would abduct Melissa Smith. And she said, as I walked in, and of course you can read this story in the Bundy Secrets, but she said, walked in, she saw him on a bar stool up at the bar. So she was going to a table where her friends were. And she said, "Oh, hey, Ted, how you doing?" He said, "Hey, Louise." And she's noticed that he was not his jovial sense. He looked different, sounded different, and that he was, you know, he was drinking alcohol. So they didn't exchange a lot of words, and then she left. She went over to the table. She said the next time she looked over, he was gone. Now we know from the record, from what we know about Bundy, we know that he would jumpstart himself many times before going out and hunting. And that's what he was doing. So that's around 8:30. By 10 o'clock, he's abducting Melissa Smith. That was this bar that she was at with him. It's called Widow McCoy's. And it was very close to where Melissa was, the pepperoni pizza, where she had gone up there to visit her friend. And people theorized that he was in there. Somebody testified later that he was in there after he came to light. And what's interesting, they don't know if he gave her a ride. Probably not, but that might be possible. More likely, he followed her on the way home, went ahead of her, got out and attacked her in a darkened part of the neighborhood, because there was a woman, I see in the book, at the unlikely hour of like 11 o'clock out raking leaves, and she heard one scream pierce the night air. So stories like this were coming to light. Nobody had interviewed Leslie Parmenter. She is in the record, and she testified as to what Bundy tried to do with her on February 8th in Jacksonville, tried to kidnap her from a Kmart parking lot until her brother showed up. But all these people came forward. So in Ted Bundy's Murders, you know, Mysteries, I published these. I published more things about the record with commentary and other things, which is very interesting, digging deeper in the record about the victim. So I get done with that 2 days after it's published. I got to tell you, when the book of mine is published, I like to relax. I like to take some time and just relax.
Right.
See how the book's doing, do some interviews. I'm not thinking about any other books. That was going to be it for me. I was contacted by a fella, and he does a lot of work in the Civil War area, but he's got a real interest in Ted Bundy. So he said, "Have you ever thought about doing an encyclopedia of Ted Bundy?" I said, "My publisher just published this book on Bundy. It's the fourth book. It's supposed to be the final book." I said, "No." And then I said, "You know what? I think I'll table that for now." He said, "Well, I would do it myself, but I'm just too busy." I said, "Well, that's a good idea. I admit it." So a couple of days later, kept feeling good about it. So I called my publisher, and I said, I thought maybe the publisher would say, "Oh, no, we're really not interested right now." And I could say, "Oh, good. Put it on the shelf and forget it." But they liked the idea. So here I go again on the fifth book. But it was different. It was an encyclopedia, and there is nothing out there on Bundy like it. There are encyclopedias of killers, obviously, but nothing
right.
exclusively about Bundy. So I wrote the book. It was kind of a fun book to write because I was able to delve into the lives of a lot of people that were a part of the story, be they newspaper writers or somebody else. But beyond their role there, I didn't know a lot about them. So I kind of got, I was able to dig into their stories. And so it was interesting to write. So that was published. So I, you know, after a while, I had the feeling, I said, you know, there's some other avenues that more people have contacted me. There's some other avenues that I would like to explore with Ted Bundy that have to do with a lot of questions and controversies and things that heretofore have not been answered or certainly not been answered to a substantial way. And I said, between that and some other things I've got going with the book and the new interviews, I'm going to do one last Bundy book. And so I have done it. I'm so happy that I did it. I did something that I never really thought I would do. In 2007, 2008, I interviewed, I interviewed a lot of people for the book, The Bundy Murders, but some of them I interviewed on tape. And those on tape were Jerry Thompson, Don Patchen, and Ron Holmes. I even interviewed Jim Massey, but I couldn't locate the tape, so I wrote a piece about Massey in the sixth book, covering a lot of things he told me. But I transcribed all of these other three tapes, and it was like I had forgotten so much of it. It's so interesting to see these now in that people can read. They're transcribed. Those will be in the book, and so there's just a lot in there. So I was really glad I did this last sixth book, and that'll be out in late November. That's the last I heard from my publisher. So it's been a long run. I've written, after this new book is published, it's going to be a little over 1,400 pages, and that's a lot of writing about one man and one case. But because the case is so voluminous, covering so many people in so many states, but I've left a great body of work for people concerning Ted Bundy. And that makes me really happy because it makes me feel like I've really done my job. But it all started with the Bundy murders. And it's been a great ride, but I got to tell you, it was an unexpected one.
Mm-hmm. You write in the preface to the 2020 edition that this investigative journey took over 2.5 years and put you in touch with hundreds of people and tens of thousands of pages of official documents.
Yes.
In the life and murders of Ted Bundy. You decided early on to approach this story in a way that was different from what previous writers had done. So when people think they've read everything, what was your different approach and in writing this book?
Well, you know, I did want to do it differently. I wanted to write a book where the reader would find themselves, except for the first chapter where Bundy is kind of hidden in the shadows, but the majority of the book, I wanted it to be like people were right behind Bundy, riding right in the back seat or walking with him, and you'd be seeing it from his perspective, and you were right there. What I like to say, in real time, as all of these events occur, be they with Bundy or be they with the victims, potential victims, Susan Rancourt, George Ann Hawkins, everybody. And, you know, a lot of people have said that have read my writing. They say that I heard it again just the other day from a couple people. They said, you're a really good storyteller. And I said, well, that's interesting. And the one person said, really good storyteller and narrator. And I said, funny that you should say that about storytelling, because I said, two of these documentary people from two different networks, once they interviewed me and I did the shoots, both of them said, and I never said a word about it, they said, you know, you are a really good storyteller. So I said to this lady the other day, I said, well, I said, you know, that's it's true. That's how I wanted to present the story. And I said, I guess you could put it in terms of being a good storyteller, because I have people, I have the reader following me, following right along with Bundy. And it just, I knew by doing it that way, it was going to shape the book a little bit differently than what other writers have done. And also I had the benefit of writing my book some 20 years after the events, which allowed some of these detectives to open up more, like Mike Fisher did, and tell me things that he otherwise wouldn't have if I had gotten a hold of him back when Bundy was just being put to death. But it's the way I told the story, and it's resonated with people, and they really like it from that aspect. Now, I don't consider my book in competition with any other Bundy book. It's just different. That's the only thing I can say about it. It does have new information, or it did as of 2012. A lot of people have taken that information and used it in publications since that time. And of course, that's fine. It's really fine if they give me credit for it. But if they don't, it's still out there, and that's it was out there in 2012. I mean, 2009, when the book was published. So I think it just goes back to how I decided to write the book, and people feel like it's kind of up close and personal, and that's the way I wanted to do it. And thankfully, I've had a knack for it, and it really paid off in writing a book like The Bundy Murders, because I got to follow his life through so many states and through so many years, and I took the same approach to the victims as they would come into his life and disappear. There's just kind of like that up close and personal look.
Let's get to that storytelling, because we have to compress an incredible story into a short period of time and still have people understand what it is you bring to the story. In reading other Bundy books, what I think you bring here, and it's evident, is that you've done the necessary research 20 years after the fact. And in that, you have these connections like Dr. Robert T. Keppel and Michael Fisher, Don Patchen, the work of Dr. Al Carlisle, William Hagemeyer from retired FBI agent. And so what you did is you filled in, as you write, all the gaps. And so what we want to start with is in this incredible story in January of 1974, where Ted Bundy is showing his face, but still we do not know, no one knows the nature of this beast. But January 31st, you talk about Linda Ann Healy, who's 21 years old, and she's a senior at the University of Washington at Seattle, and she's near her graduation. But unlike many other books, you take us to January 4th, 1974, a few weeks before this, to Terry Caldwell. And it's not a real name. Tell us what happens on January 4th to inform us how things must have happened on January 31st. So tell us about January 4th, 1974, and Terry Caldwell before we talk about Linda Ann Healy's disappearance.
And let me say this, too, that when I did a serial killer conference at Duquesne University and spoke there back in September, I talked about how Bundy, and the reason why I'm saying this now is so that the listeners will have an idea. Having studied him for years, I found a pattern of Bundy. And if you look at the attack on Terry Caldwell on January 4th, and her real name is Karen Sparks, I use it as a pseudonym. In this case, I felt like I had to, because someone told me years ago that Karen Sparks was not the real name. Well, be that as it may, so I've got three pseudonyms in the book. That's one of them. But I used Terry Caldwell. I'll do the other one with Diane Edwards, because I write a lot about her, and I did that for legal reasons, so I gave her a pseudonym, and I do it with the doctor that was with Karen Campbell and Dr. Raymond Godowski, her boyfriend, in there. I call him Dr. Brinkman. It's really Dr. Rosenthal, but those are the only three. But in any event, if you notice the murder, Bundy started attacking women in the wee hours of the morning, and would gradually back it up to earlier times in the evening. And by the time he was seen which was probably the first time where he exposed himself to potential victims on the campus of CWSC, where he got Susan Rancourt at around 10 o'clock on April 17th. But he exposed himself a little bit in the late afternoon, but then he went back to all nighttime abductions until his blinding light of day double attack at Lake Sammamish on July 14, 1974. That created so much stirring of everybody, and so many people saw him and gave composite drawings, that he went back into the shadows. Nobody ever talked about this before, and I don't even talk about this in the Bundy murder. This is something I've come to more recently and spoke about it for the first time publicly at the Hunting the Hunters conference in Pittsburgh back in September. But he goes back into the darkness after that because I think he knew he kind of bit off more than he could chew with that large daylight attack where 40,000 people were there under the beautiful sun at Lake Sammamish. Okay, and you won't see him again do a daylight attack that we know of until Denise Oliverson, which happens in, you know, like the spring of 75. Anyway, Bundy first attacked. He may have killed before 1974. That's fine. I think he did. He even told Bob Keppel, yeah, there was one in 73. He said 72, but then immediately backed out. I think he lied to Keppel. He took it back. He said, oh, no. That could be someone that's very young that he didn't want to talk about. But he attacked this lady named Karen Sparks. Karen lived in a basement apartment in the university district. She was not a student, and there were some other guys in the house, but she lived in a basement apartment, and you could actually stare into her room if the curtains weren't closed, but they had a habit of leaving the back door unlocked. Well, I do not believe for a second Bundy just stumbled in there. He was a peeping Tom. He was all over there. He started, that we know of, going and looking at windows in 72, maybe even a little bit earlier, where he would just, you know, walk around and look, and he'd stare, and he would masturbate in the bushes if he saw a naked woman do a thing. This is what he did. But he must have seen her. He knew she was there. But anyway, he got down in her apartment, no doubt through that unlocked door. And he had a speculum with him. And where do they think that he obtained the speculum? He had worked for a medical supply company. And from that supply company, he had pilfered plaster of Paris. Authorities think he took the speculum from there, and he may have gotten crutches from there because he had crutches. Lifts all the crutches later. He lied about who they belonged to, and he said, I have to give them back or whatever. But he goes in there and he severely beats this woman, and he ends up ramming this speculum up her vagina. He did a lot of damage there. He did a lot of damage to her skull. And I'm sure when he left, he believed that she was going to expire. She would die. But so he didn't carry her out like he would do with his next abduction with Linda Ann Healy. So he left her, and he was that convinced that she would die. Well, the next morning, one of the guys looked in on her, but she was sleeping. The covers were up. They didn't bother her. But at 7:30 at night, that very night, one of the guys who had heard she, was sleeping in the morning, looked in on her. She still hadn't moved. So they went and they uncovered the blanket or whatever. And she was beaten so severely. They didn't even know if she was dead. She was either looked dead or very looked like she was close to death. So an ambulance was called. And they came and got her. She spent 30 days in a hospital. I believe she was in a coma for 10, but she did survive. And she's out there now. Now, here's what I think Bundy did. I think Bundy was perturbed, and he said to himself, I can't prove this, but there's a lot of circumstantial weight behind it because of how vastly different these attacks were. So he attacked Karen Sparks or Terry Caldwell in my book on January 4th, 74. On January 31st of 74, I believe Bundy was in Dante's Tavern. And right. Dante's Tavern is just a couple blocks from Lynn and Healy's place. I've been to both locations. It's an easy walk. And she went with two of her friends, and she went with a guy named Pete Neal. Pete Neal is he's just a friend, but he had a brush with history, and his name is going to forever be enshrined with going and seeing them at the house, going to Dante's with them. And as they came home, he went in the house. He had to catch the 941 bus back to his area of town, so he grabbed some record albums that he wanted to take back home with him that were his. And Bundy told the writer, Stephen Michaud, about concerning that night, of course, all in the third person, that he went to the front, that he, in other words, it's like he followed them home. He went to the front door, and he checked it, turned the knob, and the door opened. He did not enter the door at that time. Now, this won't be as soon as they returned home, but he had been watching the house.
Mm-hmm.
And he did it, and he said, so, you know, Michaud says, well, did you enter it at that time? He said, no, I left and I came back in the middle of the night. So he said, but he had no compunction about going through people's homes in the middle of the night. So this is why it makes me think that he very well may have killed Amory Burr. We don't know. He certainly alluded to it with all the denials. He alluded to it and really tagged himself to it with Ron Holmes. And you'll hear about that people that I write about it a little bit in the Bundy murders, but you'll actually hear you'll be able to read the transcript from Holmes. But so he goes back and he gets in there. Now, what makes this thing surreal, and I've always said that, you know, of all the time I've studied murder, I have never found an abduction more surreal or more weird than this.
Yeah.
He goes in the middle of the night. He, without question, he must have entered through the front door. He goes down, and they think women are just, they're in the different rooms, but in the basement, there's Karen Scavine, might be Scavone, but she's down, and she's on the right. As you go down the steps, mm-hmm. there's a side door that leads down the steps. The side door is closer to the front of the front door. You come up the front walkway, and you hit there's a first set of steps, and then there's a walkway that leads to the right of the house. I doubt if he entered that way because he'd already tried the front door. He walked up the second steps, entered the front door, made his way to the basement. Some people think that maybe he targeted Healy. I don't know if that's true. I think he targeted the women there.
Right.
And he gets down to the basement. When you walk down these basement steps, I got a picture of it in the book, and there's when it bottoms out, but there's three more steps to the right, there's an old kind of vacuum cleaner there that was sitting there. The police took a shot of this. And so he goes downstairs, turn to the right. When he gets down to the right, he's faced with two rooms that are separated. And they're individual rooms, but they're really only separated by painted partitions of plywood. They don't have a lot of privacy. But Linda and Healy was straight in front of him, and Karen was on the right. Well, he goes in there, no doubt shuts the door. Some people have mistakenly think that Bundy clubbed Healy, but that's not true. We know it's not true because there's no blood spatter. There's only
right.
blood flow on the bed.
Mm-hmm.
And what he told Michaud, when Michaud, you know, wanted to know how this person did that, he said, well, you'd have to, I think Bundy said something like you have to go into the physiology of choking somebody and how a nosebleed can happen from that. And so mm-hmm. here Linda's sleeping. She didn't even go to sleep until probably around 1 or something. I think Karen next door, I think she went down the basement. She said I was asleep probably around 1:30. But he choked her. She must have awakened and then choked her back into unconsciousness. She had a nosebleed. Here's what he does. He takes, you know, once she's out cold, you know, choking somebody. And you have to assume that he's on top of her. And maybe she's kicking and making some noise, even if it's just kicking against the up and down on the bed. Who knows? But he's mm-hmm. not bothered by that. Once he gets her unconscious, he takes the nightie off and hangs up in the closet. He grabs I believe it was a red backpack, put some clothes in it. takes her off the bed. He would either have had to put her on in a chair, probably, or on the floor, probably a chair. And then he makes the bed. What I like to say in military fashion, because it was a really well-made bed, and there was two things about that. It was a weeknight. It was actually a Friday night. Well, actually, it was a Thursday night. Thursday now in morning, early Friday morning, when he did this. So it was still the weekday. And Linda never made her bed during the week because she had to be at Northwest Ski Promotions doing the weather reports that morning before she's in class 2 hours or 4 hours later, what have you. She never made her bed. And the other people did. And so the residents testified to that. And they said not only does she not make the bed during the week, but she can't make it like that. It's too well made. So he grabs her. Now, we don't know. He probably wrapped her in a blanket. I think he covers with Michelle that she wasn't dressed. I can't imagine him trying to dress her, but he took some clothes to backpack with him. Now, when you come out the side door, you can do two things. You can turn to the right and go down the sidewalk, and you'll have one short flight of steps to go down. They're steep, but, you can do it. You're carrying somebody. Or you can take a left, go to the backyard, and there's a fence, and there's no gate. But he would have had to have laid her down, kind of like dropped her over the fence. And the alleyway is really narrow, but there is an alcove, I think a little bit down from there, where he could have parked the VW. Because if he parked it right there at that gate, it kind of effectively blocks another car from going around, and he wouldn't have wanted that. But, when I was describing this on ABC, you kind of get both scenarios, and they used the one, and that's a great doc, that ABC doc 2020, which they replayed a year later and then put Liz Kendall and her real daughter in it. And I'm still there in all those scenes, and they even add some. But in any event, and they went with the one where he took her down the front steps, and that may be exactly what he did. Or he could have gone out the back. But in one way or another, he had his car close enough by. Still, this was bold, exceedingly bold abduction. It's a bold abduction. Never heard anything like it. And he gets her in the car, and off she goes. Well, what do I think he did that for? Why didn't he just sexually assault her and then just make sure he killed her there? Well, for two reasons. I think, one, he wanted to make sure that she really was dead. But, two, I think he had a desire to play with her some at the place where he was going to murder her and then leave her body, or they could have been two separate locations. So he does that, and, of course, here comes the – oh, and something else happened, which I absolutely believe it's Bundy. We can't prove it. The following day, or I should say, since she disappeared in the middle of the night, the early morning, everybody gets up. They're wondering where she is. It's kind of worrisome. Her bike is there, so they think maybe she had a nosebleed, but the bike's there. She wouldn't walk away. She didn't show up in classes that day. She never came home. She was having her parents there that night and her brother for dinner, and she had never come home. And so here comes, the father comes over. He feels so sorry for the father and the brother. And they don't know what to do. And father calls the wife. Mr. Healy calls and don't come over. She said, if you call the police, no, I think I'll wait a while. She said, no. And then she said, okay, I'll handle it. And she called herself. The patrolman comes over. But around 8:30 that night, and throughout the night, two calls or maybe more came through where, one of the young women answered it. And instead of anybody talking, she could hear breathing on the other end.
Right.
But the person, I have to think that's Ted Bundy. He was a game player. And I think he had known about that house. I don't know if he was hunting for Linda per se. I frankly think he just zeroed in on them, maybe recognized Linda, maybe recognized one of the other ones too, because he was a UW student as well. And he followed them home. So I think that's probably how this thing occurred. But it's a fantastic, an odd, a strange abduction. And so that's how he pulled that one off. So it's the difference between Karen Sparks and Linda Ann Healy. But yet, in a strange way, I think they might be kind of leaked. He was going to make sure that the Healy abduction didn't end up like the Spark attack, which caused her to be able to live.
Yes. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop just for a second to talk about our sponsor, which is ZipRecruiter. Hiring can be difficult, but if you're a company that's currently trying to hire, you face new difficulties, from safely reopening your doors to finding the right person for a specialized role. HousingWire could relate. They needed to hire an ambitious reporter to cover news stories on the U.S. mortgage and housing markets, so they turned to ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter's smart matching technology finds people with the right experience for your job. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. And that's how HousingWire found Alexandra Roja. Alexandra never imagined she could get a reporter job in the midst of COVID-19. Hiring was frozen, and the idea of looking for a job was discouraging. So she created a profile on ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter matched Alexandra to HousingWire's reporter job because her degree and writing skills were a great fit for the role. HousingWire received her application only 4 hours after they posted the job. And a few weeks later, Alexandra started her dream career. ZipRecruiter helped Alexandra find the right job, and they helped HousingWire find the right person for their role fast. See how ZipRecruiter can help you hire. Try it now for free at ZipRecruiter/murder. That's ZipRecruiter.com/murder. Now, Kevin, we were talking about the strange abduction Linda Ann Healy. And another woman that you talk about shortly after this is Donna Manson. And again, you write that she was likely unaware of Terry Caldwell or Linda Ann Healy. And what you read about here with Donna Manson is the way, especially early on, and probably throughout this, but especially early on, where people dismissed the disappearances, even though they were quite strange disappearances, because of certain circumstances or characteristics of that victim. Again, we're talking about the 70s, and no one has any experience with serial killers and their behavior. So tell us a little bit about Donna Manson before we talk about Kathleen D'Olivio.
Yeah, the Manson case is an interesting one. We don't know whether Donna had heard about the girls in Seattle, but even if she had, which, you know, I don't know. We don't know how much she was paying attention to news. A lot of college kids, they don't like, they're too busy doing their own things. So she may not have heard about it, but even if she did, I don't think she'd have been too concerned about it, because Olympia, Washington is a good distance away, and that's where Evergreen State College is. And when you hear of murders in another city, even in your state, you think, well, you know, that's there. Thank God it's not here. But Bundy was familiar with the campus of Evergreen State College, and it's a pretty college, but it is all, and it's, as I say in the book, it's, you know, it was built in the midst of a forest of fir trees, and the concrete structure known as Evergreen is sitting in all this natural beauty, and it works well. And when I was there in 2015, it's a beautiful place, but it's also this. It also can be quite creepy when you think in terms of murderers, serial killers, abductions, because what you have on the campus, you have a lot of trails on that campus. And when students are walking the trails, whether they're by themselves or with a group, it doesn't matter, they're encased in trees. And so as the story goes, and the facts are, Donna, on the early evening of that she was in a, you have to get a kind of look at it, that the first year dorms was to the right, a pretty good distance of where she was going. Nobody had identified until my book, The Trail of Ted Bundy, Digging Up the Untold Stories. Everybody knew that Donna was heading to a jazz concert somewhere on the campus, but nobody really knew where. So when I went to Evergreen State College, I went to the archives department, and lo and behold, there's a guy named Randy there. He had started work there in 1974. This was 2015, and he was still there. So I asked him if there was a way if we could find out exactly where that jazz concert was. So, and I got the tour of the campus. He said, well, I'm going to have to do some really in-depth research about this to see if I can locate it. So he said, give me your number. And I said, sure. And so, you know, I said, okay, well, you know, we'll be in touch. So I leave the campus. My wife and I leave, taking photographs. We've walked everywhere. This guy's office was down in the basement area of the library, and I have a picture of the library in the book. Anyway, a number of days later, he contacts me and he sends me some files, and I open them up, and one of them is the Evergreen State College bulletin that was published in their newspaper, what have you. And for the evening of her disappearance, the jazz concert, there it is right there on the publication, and it occurred within the library. So when she left her dorm, she was walking by herself. She had her grandmother's coat on, and I say in the book it must have felt really good because it was a little drizzly, cool, and it was cool. And she headed off down this trail. We know the trail. There's two trails, but she would have been going out of her way to take the other one. So we know the trail that she was on. And near that trail, there is a, and I talk about this more also in the sixth book that's coming out, but there's a road right next to it. Now, we don't know if she ever made it to the library, but we don't think so. From what we know, she probably disappeared on that trail, or perhaps right as she cleared it, if Bundy were hanging out near an area by the library. But nobody remembered seeing her. The jazz concert was on the first floor. Cops did interviews. Nobody saw her. Nobody can recall seeing her outside on the concrete areas or in the area where, she would have been if she would, let's say, ran into somebody and would be talking to him. So chances are, and we don't know, but it may be that Bundy parked on that road, like it's a service road, I think, and either waylaid her and carried her a short distance to his car, or because Donna liked to do drugs and things like that, and she wasn't the greatest student, and I talk about that in the book, he may have lured her away through the use of drugs. We don't know. But we do know that we do suspect, and I say we, all the research, I mean, I do as a researcher, and I think other people do too, that once it came out where she was going to, and it was published for the first time in my book, The Trail of Ted Bundy, then you look at a map of it, you know where she was in her first year dorm and where the library is and the trail you have to cross. Everybody comes to the same conclusion. If nobody saw her up in the library or outside of it, there's no reports of that, no matter how many people they interviewed. She had to have disappeared on the trail, and probably the trail was empty. So, because everybody else that wanted to get to the library probably got there sooner and maybe was coming from another direction. So, but it's an interesting college. But you look around, it's perfect for a predator. And Bundy had to have recognized this. So, and she's also the person that when, she's a Washington State murderer, when Keppel was talking to Bundy about this, he asked him some details about it, and Bundy must have been really inebriated, maybe not so much as he grabbed her, but as he took her probably unconscious, or soon he made her unconscious on the way out of the school campus or whatever he did, he probably knocked her out And then he probably just heavily got, because he said it's all like a blur. It's almost like a dream-like kind of thing. And he didn't really want to discuss it all that much. But, yeah, it's a strange abduction.
Mm-hmm. Let's get to Susan Elaine Rancourt. She's 18 years old, and she worked full-time in this nursing home and went to school, and she vanished. But you write, unlike Donna Manson, Susan Rancourt's disappearance was not taken lightly. Her roommate filed a missing persons report the next day. So what happens with this investigation? Again, this is slow going for investigators, of course, but because this is different, what do they find?
Yeah, in the case of Susan Rancourt, I mean, you can start comparing some of Bundy's victims, and some of them were kind of, you know, they had a tendency to get up and go, and, you know, it wouldn't be until a week or so later when people start to, you know, I wonder if something's wrong. But that wasn't the case with Susan Rancourt. Susan had her head really screwed on well. She knew where she was going. She wanted to go into, she was thinking about going into medicine. She kept a 4.0 average, even though she was working. And she was in the midst of actually switching jobs, but she was going to keep working and keep working hard in school. And in that very day, she, and I point this out in the book because I found it in the record, she went sunbathing in a like a park there in Ellensburg, and had no idea that come 10 o'clock at night she would run into Bundy. Bundy had gone to Central Washington State College, which is over the Cascade Mountains. And it's funny because, you know, Bundy had a good friend. He had two good friends growing up, and they were Terry Storwick and Warren Dodge. They were best friends, the three of them. And when he made that trip over to Central Washington State College in Ellensburg, now it's called Central Washington University, Terry Storwick was there. I mean, I think he still had some classes there, and I think he had a girlfriend there and whatever. But Bundy could have run into her, but he wanted to go there, and he wanted to go hunting. And it's clear that he hunted on a couple days, a couple different days there. But on the night that he got Susan Rancourt at 10 o'clock, he was actually in the afternoon spotted there by some people, including a fellow named Kent Barnard that is in the record. And then I interviewed Kent for the Trail of Ted Bundy, and he elaborated on more things about Bundy that just didn't show up on the record, where he spotted him later that night or whatever. But you know, interesting guy to talk to. But he didn't get anybody. He tried to abduct another woman, and that, you know, that didn't work out for him. And Bundy is also, he was just so cunning. By the time I was there in 2015, it had changed, but Bundy centered basically on Bullion Library. And behind Bullion Library at the time, Bullion Library was situated, and all students, even if they parked in a parking lot, like in the back, they had to enter the library in the front. They couldn't enter it from the rear. So Bundy did all his kind of like hunting up in the front of the library, or maybe on the side. If you walk to the side of the Bullion Library, there it is situated between, and there's a pretty good distance, not, you know, but it's situated between the library, and then you're looking on a building that's facing the side of the library a little distance away, called Black Hall, not the Black Hall of today, where it's been added to, and it's an H shape with a connecting corridor, but it was just one building. And today there's buildings all around this area. And at the time that Bundy was there, there was just Black Hall facing one building facing the side of the library, and then there was a small building called the Group Conference Center. And then between the Group Conference Center and the library, there was a man-made pond and a bridge you had to walk over. And people that read the record will be, you know, they'll be able to see this about the bridge. Bundy had parked in an area, now in the area behind the library and going past the library where it would be in front of Black Hall. And then there's just nothing. This is where a railroad line used to go through, and there was a railroad to Trestle Park there. It was in Bundy Park in a no parking area in the most desolate area on the campus he could find, and not well lighted, overgrown with grass, and he had parked. I mean, you take a look at that and you're a young woman, you think, you know what, I don't want to go there, but this guy seems to be normal. In any event, he parks there. At the time, there was a parking lot directly behind the library, but not where he had parked. And there was a parking lot like north of that. And today, that's all one parking lot, and the trestle's gone. So I've, you know, with the help of a man named Dave, a Facebook friend named Dave Woody, he's charted all this out and proved exactly where that trestle ran through. And I've taken pictures of that spot, and people have seen those. But at the time, you know, it was just a very desolate area. And I say in the Bundy murders, it's a great place to commit a murder or at least begin one. And by the time he reached area with the one woman that he wasn't able to abduct, she had helped him with his books there. And, you know, the Diolabo, lady, she helped him with his books. And when she got to the car, she was a little suspicious of him, of course, and she was ready to whack him with the books if she needed to. And he's on, he has a sling on his arm and stuff. He looked like he's having a hard time. She sees that the passenger the passenger seat is out. But in any event, she doesn't go with him. She helps him, but then leaves. He doesn't have a chance to attack her. He had no doubt placed the crowbar like he did in the Hawkins abduction and the Julie Cunningham abduction, and he carried a short 17 and a half inch crowbar called a Sears model 6577. Maybe there's some competing models, but they're the small crowbars, they're not the long ones. And he could easily wheel that in his car, but he used to place that behind sometimes like the right tire or the rear, in that rear area, like right by the right tire, so he could, as they're helping him put in books or crutches, he could pull that tire iron out and whack him. He doesn't have a chance to do that with the one girl. Turns out that when he ran into Susan Rancourt that night, she had placed some. She had a meeting to become a dorm camp counselor on campus, and she had walked down a couple blocks down from the library to a building called Munson Hall. She lived on the other side of the campus in Bartle Hall, and after she had the dorm counselor meeting, she was heading back to get her clothes out of the dryer. She passed the library, which she runs in. The Bundy, not at the library, but I think the street, a street or so before it, and somebody saw her and identified her by what she was wearing, and also identified a man who looked like he was in a daze, wearing like a ski parka jacket. Okay? Yeah. And so he must have run into her there, did the helpless thing. Susan Rancourt, a sweet girl, not suspecting a thing, said she would help him. And, of course, this time, his victim would not get away. And she made her way down there, and they would have passed the exact same way, between the library, across the man-made bridge. Then as soon as you cross the man-made bridge, which you can see today, even though the bridge is gone, the pond's gone, there's the newer cement that follows that trail. It's the same thing. And then they would have angled off to the left and kept walking about 150 feet, walked under the trestle, and then around to where Bundy's car was parked. So, and then, of course, what was so extremely weird, Kent Barnard said that it was his birthday, April 17th, by the way, and he had gone to Central Washington State College to visit his girlfriend. And during that whole night, he saw him a couple of times, but yeah, he saw Bundy a couple of times. He saw him up by the Arctic Circle, and that came out in the trail of Ted Bundy. And And then, of course, he had seen him earlier at the library. But he saw the strangest thing. You know, so he was with his girlfriend. By the time Bundy got Rancourt and left the university, he was still there. Ken Barnard was still there. He didn't leave until somewhat later. But he's on the highway on the way home. And he looks up at the Issaquah hillside, but he sees a small set of round taillights glowing up there. That's the taillights of Bundy's car.
Right.
He's got Rancourt up there. And so, you know, he'll never forget that. And mm-hmm. nice guy. I had a good long conversation with him on the phone back in late 2014, early 2015. But early 2015. But in any event, you know, this thing about Bundy and his ability to snatch people without anybody really seeing what was going on. And Bundy remarked that when he was talking to Michelle in the third person, he said, you know, like the last thing you want to do, I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but this is what he said. The last thing you want to do is be seen by somebody, walking somebody to your car. And, but, you know, there were times also when he would lead somebody to an area. And he said, for some reason, I just called it off. And he had done that in the area of where George Ann Hawkins would disappear in, that summer on June 11th. But, yeah, and so it worried him later. He thought, well, if anybody says, you know, well, I saw this weird guy 2 weeks before Crutches, and he walked me to his car. He said, he lives in the district where he drives a Volkswagen. So it horrified him that because he let that one woman go, she could end up giving the cops information on the Hawkins abduction that could lead them right to him.
You write about July 14, 74, Lake mm-hmm. Sammamish State
yeah.
Park, east of Seattle, 40,000 people. And mm-hmm. again, incredible. You can't write this in fiction. A DEA agent mm-hmm. named Jerry Snyder is there with his family.
Uh-huh.
And witnesses
yeah,
a young girl named Janice Ott, who's 23 years old. Janice Ann Ott. Why
yes.
is this why is this a turning point, as you write, in this early investigation? Why is this different? What does he do? Tell us about this incredible event.
Now, and there's some additional stuff that goes with that that I'll mm-hmm. tell you that most of your listeners won't know, but not about Bundy, but about someone else. That was there. Interestingly enough, Bundy had been to the same lake a week earlier, and he actually ran into some friends there, so he knew the possibility of coming back to hunt for women at Lake Sammamish. He could run into somebody, but I guess that didn't bother him. And why he chose to abduct two at Lake Sammamish in one day, Janice Ott in the morning and Denise Nathlin in the afternoon, is anyone's guess. I call it like a homicidal boast in the book. I do think he was really trying to make a statement. He felt like he was absolutely invincible. But what a place to hunt, because the place mm-hmm. was, as you say, 40,000 people. There were a lot of company picnics there. Even a police department was having a company picnic.
Jeez.
But this didn't bother Ted Bundy. And so it turns out that, he is able to get Janice Ott that morning. But what is interesting, Jerry Snyder, a DEA agent, is sitting back with his dog, and he watches this. His family, his wife and kids are there, but they're kind of like farther away from him because the kids were going to the water on the beach, and he couldn't take the dog down that close, so he sat back. So he notices mm-hmm. this guy coming down the right, and he's looking at women, and he's stopping and looking, and, you know, and then he move on, and then he makes his way to Janice Ott, and he sees Janice Ott sitting there, and they strike up a conversation. Now, here's where something different comes in, because he sees that Snyder sees this, this man who came to the right didn't stop and talk to anybody else. But he stopped and talked to Ott, and then she offered him to sit down. And they began talking. I don't know how much Snyder hears, but there's a young girl named Valant right next to him, within a few mm-hmm. feet of them. And she's 15 years old, Sylvia Valant. And she hears most of the conversation between Bundy and Ott. And she reports on it later, and Snyder backs it up. And so they have this conversation, and Bundy is saying, and he's got his arm in the sling, and acting like he hurt it, and he needed help with his sailboat. And she said, well, that means I get to ride in your sailboat. And he said, yeah, and I can teach you. And she said, what about my bike? And he said, well, it'll fit in the trunk. And you probably had to take the one wheel off and put it in there. But whatever he did, he got it in the trunk. And so these people saw this. Now, Snyder would testify to all this. Sylvia Valant, the 15-year-old kid, would testify to all this. And there were some other people that saw this too. Now, when I was on the dock, the HLN dock, which is like CNN, and so it was a 4-part series. They interviewed Sylvia Valant. She's a grown woman now. Now her name is Mexner now, Sylvia Mexner. Now she tells a story that's totally different from the written record. And I'm not saying it's not true. I'm not saying anything like that. What I am saying is, she in the documentary has Bundy stopping and talking to her and trying to get her to go with him. And mm-hmm. she said, I think in the documentary, that Janice overheard it and she offered her something. But that's not what I've got Sylvia Valant's statement a couple of days after Lake Sammamish. I've got it in the file. She never said that Bundy talks to her. He goes straight over to Ott. Snyder doesn't report that this man stopped with anybody and talked to anybody mm-hmm. until he got to that. And then I have another report where they came and visited, where Kathy McChesney, I believe it was, went and visited the 15-year-old Sylvia Valant, and in November of that year, long after the thing, and she doesn't bring up that she talked to Bundy also. I don't know what happened there. I'm just saying that there is, if anybody was watching that doc and knows mm-hmm. the story, and the reason why I'm bringing it up, because I had a guy call me and say, look, isn't that Valant from the, 50? Yeah. And I say, yeah, that's her. Well, why is she saying she talked to Bundy? Because it's not in the record. I said, well, your guess is as good as mine, because I got the testimony. I've got her signed statement. She never mentions Bundy talking to her, ever. And so I don't know, why that happened, and nobody else seemed to have seen it. So maybe she knows something that we don't. Bundy said something we don't know. I don't know anything about it. But because that's out there now and people have said something to me about it, I'm just letting you know that it's not in the original record. I'm not saying it didn't happen. I'm saying that, if Bundy did say anything to her, maybe it was a hello or I don't know. I'm just saying mm-hmm. there's a discrepancy there, and we don't know what's what. But yes, he ended up, he got her off to agree with him to go. So she packed everything up, and she went to the parking lot. And a woman that he had tried to abduct, that even walked with him to his car, and he wanted help with the boat. She said, "There's no boat. There's no trailer." He said, oh, it's at my parents' house up in Issaquah. Right. Oh, she said, I can't leave. My husband and my parents are coming, whatever, my family's coming. I can't do it. He said, oh, I'm very sorry. He walked back in. He said, I'm really sorry. He said, I guess I should have said something. And he was very polite. So as Ott is walking her bike out with Bundy, she sees them. And her thought was, can't remember her name, it's in the book. She goes, well, that didn't take him too long to find somebody else. And, you know, she's really the last one to, I guess, pay any attention to Ott because she's with Bundy. But it's an interesting, it's a terrible abduction. It's a bold abduction. And again, he would come back later that afternoon and abduct Denise Naslund, actually get her willingly follow him to his car. And obviously there's no boat, so he said, oh, he must have done the same thing except my parents' house in Issaquah. And then, bam. And then that, you know. So, in any event, yes.
You write that there is now a description of this person who said his name was Ted. And so they have some, you know, their first leads in terms of what this person would did in one day. And, of course, they were... authorities were horrified that somebody could was even capable of something, as you write, would be unthinkable. You also write about, at the same time, this incredible character, Ted's girlfriend, Liz Kendall, July 6, 74. Tell us about how it comes to be that even despite her care for Ted Bundy, she suspects him of these abductions and murders. Tell us how it comes to be that she thinks that.
Yeah, well, you know, it's really interesting. You kind of see Liz, and some people, I don't know why some people are like this, but they are critical of the Bundy family. They're critical of Liz. They don't say anything about Molly, her daughter. I call Molly Tina in my book. But they, you know, these people were victims too. And she very much loved Bundy, and it was hard for her to come to the realization of what he was. And so there would be some vacillating. But one thing about Liz, when she thought that there might be something wrong with Ted, that there could be some issues there, and maybe he could be the one, she did do the right thing, and she made a call. But what really precipitated the first call was after the authorities knew of an abductor out there, and they got some composite drawings and with Lake Sammamish. And after, you know, after these girls have gone missing, she has one of her coworkers one morning come up to her. Some guy says, I think he was trying to make a joke and be funny, but he said, look at this composite drawing, Liz. And it's got, look, they're looking for a Ted who drives a Volkswagen. And he goes, doesn't this guy kind of look like your Ted? And, of course, I'm sure they laughed. He thought it was funny. He probably didn't even suspect Ted Bundy, her boyfriend, of being involved in it. But that did bother her. And, of course, you know, Bundy had done some things that had disturbed her a bit. She noticed that by 1974, his sexual, like, excitement with her had started to wane because some of his sexual desires had changed, and now he wanted to tie her up, and he wanted to have anal intercourse, and she said no to that. She allowed him to tie her up on a couple occasions. She remarked, and I have this in the new edition, I quote, the prosecutor who had given an interview with the Atlantic Journal Constitution newspaper, and he talks about how Liz was allowing him to, like, just choke her, you know, a little bit, because he wanted to do that. And she said that, and so either said, Dave Yoakam, he said, it frightened her because she tried to get him. It looked like he wasn't there. And when she tried to get him to stop, he wouldn't come to right away. And he was in this altered state of murder, fantasizing, not wanting to kill her, but definitely had passed from this world into that internal world. And it was real different. So she put a stop to all that. But I also point out, which is interesting, if you want to look at the psychology of Bundy and the things that would happen to him and others when they go into these altered states of murder, when they took a raft trip down the Yakima on a beautiful day, he was fine that morning. They get in the Yakima. They get in the raft and they're going down the river. They already have plans to have lunch. But somewhere through before they have lunch and they're rafting, he starts to change. He starts to become moody. He starts to become quiet. And I think it's because he was communing with someone. He was in the geographical area close to where he had kidnapped and murdered Susan Rancourt. So that could have been on his mind, but he was definitely passing into a different state of mind. And I think that comes from kind of fantasizing. You know, he's trying to look at Liz and talk, but he's also thinking about this and stuff is rising up. So they stop and have lunch. He's still quiet, but, you know, at least they're together. They're having lunch. And then they get back in the raft and they're going down to Yakima. And I think her book says before like an hour is out. For no reason, he pushes her off into the Yakima. So she's, you know, it's all very sudden, and she comes up, she's gasping for breath. She said, when I looked at him, his face was blank. It's like he wasn't there. Absolutely blank. That was the monster being revealed. That was it, Bundy, in that altered state of murder. And so you could occasionally see things like this. And I remember the one, I can't remember if it's Jane Curtis or the Dio Liva woman, but I have to check my book. But one of the women noticed that when she was offering help to Bundy at CWSC at the Bullion Library area during, you know, the afternoon, his eyes looked fine. But as they traveled down that walkway, and they go on that bridge and they're heading across and they're starting to go left, his car, somewhere in there, for some reason, she turns and looks at him, and his eyes looked very weird. And she noticed the difference, and they were not that way when she first saw him. And I know that he's going into that altered state. So I asked Al Carlisle about that. And Al said, well, you know, there are a lot of testimonies from women who say that the eyes of these men change like this, right before they were attacked. He wasn't really talking about Bundy in this case, just other things other case studies he knew of. And he said, I think it's a neurotransmitter, a temporary neurotransmitter thing that does this. And so you can see that while Bundy is making himself presentable to her and he's up in front of the library or a little bit on the side of it, wherever he was, by the bicycle racks, they said at some point, he doesn't know if he's going to have her, but he's trying, and his eyes are clear. And then as he's walking down and he's sensing he's going to have her, that altered state starts to come to the surface. There it is. And it's resonating in his eyes. That's not a whole lot different from what Liz encountered, but Liz's encounter was even farther ahead in that altered state, because he's choking her. She can't bring him to for a second. And when he pushes her out of the boat, the raft, and she comes out of the water, his face is blank. He's not there. And she knows it. And it took him a second to come back to himself, apparently, pull her in the boat. And then, of course, Bundy tries to blow it off. She was very upset with him doing that, which is natural. He said, oh, it was just a joke. See, it wasn't a joke. And so you got to ask yourself, did Bundy question himself at that point, thinking, I'm having a problem controlling this? He may have done that, but these things have a life of their own. And as the time rolled on and the murders went on, you can see where Bundy had a harder time controlling, you know, some of these things. It's really an interesting thing to look at.
At around the same time, too, he has plans in 6 weeks, Liz knows about this, that he'd be moving to Salt Lake City to attend law school. And now Bob Keppel, Detective Robert Keppel, now has Ted Bundy on a list. And this is the person that also communicated with Liz as well, when she spoke to police. But because of the people that had reported Ted and because of the description of Composite, he is now, finally, he's on a list of 100 people. He's on a suspect list of 100 people. But as you write, everything else about Ted Bundy does not produce any kind of suspicion, does it?
Right. Yeah, it's an interesting thing because, you know, you don't look at a person like Bundy. I mean, the first time I heard of Ted Bundy was after his first escape in Colorado, and then he was recaptured, and I remember thinking, oh, that's good. But that was the first I heard of this man. But what they said during the CBS News report that I heard, they said he's a former law student. And I said to myself, and of course he's on trial in there for the attempted or the kidnapping of and murder of Karen Campbell, but he was suspected of others in Washington State. That was the first I ever heard of the man. But my first question was this: how on earth does a law student come under this kind of suspicion? So people that saw Bundy and knew Bundy and, you know, just didn't look like he could be the man, because here he is, a college graduate, a law student. He went to the law school for the first semester at Puget Sound College. He was a political campaigner. He'd been written about in the newspaper. He knew Richard Larson, who worked for the Seattle Times. Larson had interviewed him. I mean, he didn't look like the man that would do this. So, yeah, his name popped up. And there was three different people. Liz was one. The professor. Now, what was his name? His assistant professor, I think, made the call. But and his name is Katzenbaum. But the actual professor, it's in the book. It's my name. He or his office made a call and said, look, the professor had said, I have a weird guy in my class who drives like a 1968 Volkswagen. I think he would be worth checking out. His name is Ted Bundy. So that, Liz, and another source all led to him being put on this suspects list of the top 100. And they figured that they could go through that 100 in about a year. And nobody that really looked at Bundy, there was nothing there that brought up a red flag where they said, "Oh, we need to look at him closer." What happened is that as Bundy was coming to the top of that list, he was the next man to be looked at. It didn't happen before 1975, while Bundy was in Utah. And when Bundy came on their radar there, they made an inquiry. The Salt Lake made an inquiry. In fact, it was actually Ben Forbes, Terry Thompson's partner, called up there and said, look, we got this guy named Bundy down here, and he's being accused of some things. And Bundy's file had just come to the top. He was the next person there to be looked at in a far more closer manner. And it's almost like, I think I see in the book, like the gods of chance and circumstance were saying at that moment, here's your killer of women, come get him. But it was a very, very odd thing that occurred. And it was certainly a neat occurrence.
Kevin, I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about the Bundy murders, a comprehensive history. But for those people that have been listening right now, we know that it necessitates that we have a second part of this Bundy murders. So next week, and it'll be announced, people just check their feed, the Bundy murders with Kevin M. Sullivan, a comprehensive history, second edition, part two. So thank you very much, Kevin Sullivan, and we will talk to you next week for the part two of the Bundy murders.
I look forward to it. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.